You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the podcast network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. Today is Wednesday, February 27th, 2008, and welcome to Episode 8 of the Wells Tech Podcast. I'm Martin Spriggs.
And I'm Sally Draper.
And we are your hosts for our weekly conversation about technology topics and how they might relate or might impact your ministry. Good morning, Sally.
Hi, Martin. How's it going this morning?
Excellent. Had a treat last week. I was able to get out to Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, attend a Lenten service there, heard your husband share God's word with us. Really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that was nice to have you here. I guess you had meetings in the area or whatever, but anytime you can get to Sleepy Eye is just a real treat.
That's right. Not really on the way to anywhere, but I was headed for a meeting at Martin Luther College in New Ulm, and you're just down the road. So that's kind of a perk in the job that I'm in. I get a chance to visit different congregations and hear different pastors preach, and just a great experience. So thanks for that. Our discussion topic today is kind of common, you know, to all churches and schools, I think, and it was really a topic that was raised by Josh Shanick a couple weeks ago about email retention. Their congregation is kind of struggling, or their school is kind of struggling to figure out how best to deal with the kind of the difficult and maybe legally complex topic of how long do you keep email and, in general, electronic or digital records. And they came down with potentially three options. One was, well, we really don't need to worry about keeping email because there is no, you know, hard and fast legal requirement to do so. Or two, we should retain anything that we think could be used or would need to be used for legal purposes or legal, quote-unquote, discovery. So maybe that's just a few months worth. Or you kind of go to the other side of the pendulum and say, well, we need to retain everything, especially those generated by our school staff, you know, maybe for 11 years or longer. And they're thinking around 11 years would be, well, that's maybe how long we would have a student in the school, you know, from pre-K all the way through, you know, through grade school graduation. So I think he and probably many of our schools and churches are really struggling with that same question.
Exactly. I tapped our principal here in Sleepy Eye and asked him if they had an email retention policy, and he said, gee, no, you know, not something we've really considered in the past. But they do have paper policy, and so maybe that's a good starting point for developing an email retention policy around, you know, what pieces of paper are important enough to keep for the school year.
Right. I think one of the things you have to kind of determine for yourself and understand for yourself is that electronic communication is treated or should be treated no differently than hard copy communication. So whether it be correspondence or a letter or an email or a digital file, they're really kind of in the same boat at this point, aren't they?
Yes, I believe they are.
So along with that, you know, as you're thinking about an email retention policy and you know, what kind of standards you apply, one thing that all church employees and school employees need to first understand is that emails are not private. They, first of all, belong to the organization. If you're using organizational tools or an organizational email system, this is no different than corporate America. Those emails are not your own. They are public or can become public. And as you and I both know, the emails sometimes get legs. So they exist on not only your own system, but they exist on other servers elsewhere. They obviously exist in the inbox of the person that you're communicating with. And you know, maybe not even limited to that. They can find their way into all other locations as they get forwarded, or reply alls, or those kinds of things. So, you know, I think everybody needs to remember that what you communicate over email is not necessarily going to stay private. Another issue when we're thinking about an email retention policy is, do you really need one? You know, when a congregation is thinking about, or a school is thinking about, well, do we need to go to the trouble of a formal policy. I guess the conventional wisdom now for churches and schools is yes. You know, we can't and shouldn't leave that up to the discretion of our email users. We need something in writing that, you know, we can go back to when we can provide guidance for those people that are using it. One thing that I found in some of my research is that if you're in a litigious, you know, situation where emails are coming up for whatever reason as evidence, you know, in a trial or some other discovery process, they're going to first ask you, do you have a policy? And if you do have a policy, they're going to honor that. Churches and schools aren't governed by any particular rules and regulations per se. But one thing that those court systems will ask you about is, you know, what is your policy? And then if you're following that policy, you're on pretty safe ground. There is no one law, when I'm thinking about email retention, that governs that. There are certainly laws that are sitting out there that may come into play. I think about OSHA and HIPAA and the Fair Labor Standards Act. Sarbanes-Oxley is quickly becoming the standard for companies to follow, but none of them really are going to apply specifically to a church or school. So I think a good general rule of thumb is to take a look at some of those and try and incorporate what their suggestions are to your church or school. I think at some point down the line, nonprofits are going to fall under perhaps Sarbanes-Oxley, which was created to govern, you know, business use and those that those kinds of things that we're talking about here with email retention or records retention.
Well, I think one of the things you need to do is be concerned about privacy of the information. So making sure that you're storing it in a way that you can get access to it, but that others can't. You know, we have shared computers in our office setting, you know, so making sure that your email is in a secure location, that someone that just happens into the office can't get access to it. You know, being concerned about passwords and those kind of safety precautions is going to, you know, relate to whether your email is actually secure. Also, you need to be concerned with storage process, being able to access it. You know, if it's archived in your email system, that you can actually get your hands on the messages that you need to access if you do need to go back to some correspondence that you've had in the past. So, you know, having a good policy around how you actually physically store the data, you know, what server it goes on to, or, you know, if you save copies of it in a certain format or anything like that.
Are you thinking about length of retention at all when you're thinking about, you know, the emails that need to be saved or archived for some period of time? Have you given that any thought?
I think, you know, a good rule of thumb would be the 1 year thing, unless there's something that's related to a student that's going to have long-term effect on their educational process or whatever. You know, if there's correspondence related to that, then, you know, you need to look at possibly even including paper copies of that in students' permanent records and things like that. So, turning the electronic into the paper to include it in your regular filing system in permanent records.
Yeah. There are a number of technical considerations, and there are a couple ways to do that, I suppose. If you want an email retention policy, let's say maybe that is for a year or longer, one way would be to ask, you know, the users, you know, to enforce that, you know, kind of self-governing, so make sure that they're saving sent email and received email into a particular file or folder or something like that. Outlook does a good job of that because there's an auto-archiving feature that you can turn on that would actually save this down, you know, to an OST or a PST file. So that's, you know, that makes life a little bit easier, so it'll save all your sent mail, for instance, and then you don't have to save it in on your system forever. It'll archive it, which will compress it, and ultimately it'll be there if you want to go back and grab it. If you're using tools like Gmail, you have such a large capacity there on Gmail. I forget what it's up to now, maybe 6 gigabytes of storage I think you can get on Gmail. It automatically saves your sent mail, so there's a good tool there as well. Scent mail is maybe, and I think maybe in most cases, the best way to make sure that you're doing this is you're doing correspondence and responding to email. You know, you're copying the original message in that scent mail, so you've got a kind of a traveling history of a particular email. So that's maybe something that you would focus on as well.
Just in a business setting, you know, with the email that I've sent and received in the last 4+ years that I've worked for the Synod, I have a personal policy of saving just about everything. And I can tell you, you know, there's been numerous times when I've been able to dig back and find the correspondence and make use of it, you know, a year later or more. So, you know, having the storage concerns out of the way is a wonderful thing. So you can store what you need to or archive what you need to in a compressed format, so it's not taking up a lot of space. Then you have that confidence that you can go back and, you know, search out the email, the very important email correspondence, you know, that happened a year or more ago.
So lots of considerations there. I think just from a larger perspective, it's important for congregations and schools to have some kind of privacy policy that governs how you deal with especially digital information. Obviously, congregations and schools make use of volunteers, so it's sometimes hard with volunteers to figure out how best to do that. But a policy that's written and that they're required to adhere to, read, and agree to is, I think, going to be important and probably a good safeguard for congregations and schools to have, and make sure that that policy is updated regularly and then, of course, read by anybody who it might apply to. There are lots of good resources out on the internet. I was doing some searching the other day and found a couple great resources that we'll post in the show notes. The National Association of Congregational Churches, you know, that church body has taken this seriously, and they've got a good document that we'll post in the show notes, a link to. They kind of base theirs on what the ELCA has done, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. They have, in fact, a records management officer on staff that really takes time to put documents together and advice for congregations, and they've got some great resources on the ELCA website. Just good advice for congregations if they're thinking about records management and privacy concerns and what to do in different situations. So I think good stuff there as well.
Well, kind of a side topic on email and certainly tied in with privacy is just safeguarding your congregational information. When you send emails, you know, being concerned about not sharing your members' email addresses unnecessarily. And a great way to do that, and really should be adopted by anyone that would send mass emails, is to use the blind carbon copy feature in the email so that you list the email addresses you're sending to as a BCC or blind carbon copy, and when that email is delivered, the recipients cannot see who the email was actually sent to. So they're not receiving a laundry list of every email address in your congregation, which they could in turn forward on to people who could use those email addresses in less than desirable ways. So, you know, just safeguard your member emails in that way. Very simple policy to put in place that you're going to use that blind carbon copy field when you're sending email, so that you're not releasing private information to the world, you know, via the legs that those emails seem to sprout and get forwarded on.
Right. If you have any information or thoughts, questions about email retention or privacy policies, send us those. You can find our information at wellstech.wells.net. You'll see all the show notes and the links that we'll provide there. If you want to email us, that's wellstech@wells.net. You can leave us voicemail. We're on Facebook. There's a listserv. All those contact points are available on our website at wellstech.wells.net. Switching gears a little bit, we had a chance to sit down with Mark Robinson, who is a Wells member and the administrator for our Shop Wells program. Mark has been very active initially with the Synod in helping congregations figure out how to decipher their telephone bills and what is the best service, you know, that congregations and schools can use and get the lowest cost and the best service possible. So let's listen as we spend some time with Mark Robinson talking to us about telecommunications, internet providers, and the considerations that a congregation or school should should look at when they're looking at either switching providers or getting the optimal service out of their existing provider. With us today is Wells member and ShopWells administrator, Mark Robinson. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
You are the ShopWells administrator. What exactly does the ShopWells administrator do?
Well, we have a number of functions. From a telecommunications standpoint, we talk with our end users, the churches and schools, kind of talk through what they need to have, what they'd like to have, kind of what their future plans are. We try to then take those needs and match them against the vendors that are out in the marketplace today. We work on pricing things out for them, providing them, comparing the various vendors against one another, and making recommendations to them as to what we feel would best meet their needs. We collect contracts, put together those, and send them over to the clients so they don't have to worry about working with the vendors directly. We also work with the vendors on submitting the orders, making sure everything goes in as smoothly as possible. And if necessary, we'll work with them on their first bill just to make sure that things are, in fact, coming through the way they had anticipated. Obviously, the ShopWells has more than just telecommunication services, but those same things apply across the board on the other vendors as well.
So you kind of act as an agent for the church or the school, especially when you're dealing with telecommunications providers, finding them the best deal, and then kind of taking it from, you know, the start to the finish, as if they're changing programs, if they're modifying, you know, their service, those kinds of things?
Yeah, the answer would be yes. We found that in many cases it's just easier to be that middle person for them. We know obviously all the telecommunication talks, so we know how to speak to the vendors and get what we need out of there. We know how to simplify that verbiage down to the individual user to make sure that they're getting what they need and they understand it. And we just monitor that whole thing all the way through. So, yeah, we do act as an agent to kind of help as that filter. At the same time, it helps having somebody who they can trust that's going to give, you know, has their best interest in mind. Obviously, if these vendors or churches and schools are talking with individual vendors, each vendor always has the best product.
Yeah, right.
How does the customer really know it's the best product? And we find that, you know, having the perspective we do across all the different vendors, we're able to kind of cut to the chase based on what they need. And I think that brings a level of confidence to the customer. We also know what are in the contracts that they need to be aware of. The gotchas. Mainly, one of the bigger issues is, you know, kind of what's the liability? What would it cost a customer to get out of a contract if they find a better deal elsewhere? I mean, that's something that needs to be considered that I think most people don't really look at because obviously it's something you wouldn't think of needing until you're there.
So, right. Right. Now, when we're talking about vendors, we're really talking about telecommunication providers who provide typically phone service, but they also provide internet service as well. Is that what you're typically finding?
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, most companies that exist, and there was an FCC rule change made a couple of years ago that was lobbied for by AT&T and Verizon, the two largest telecommunication providers, and because of that, those lobbying efforts, telecommunication companies have evolved to needing to be what are known as facility-based carriers, meaning they absolutely have to have equipment in the geographical areas they intend to service. This differs than what it used to be, which is they could buy and resell other carrier services to customers at whatever markups they wanted. Because of that rule change, though, and having to put equipment in the geographical areas they intend to service, that equipment really does service both the voice and the internet side of it because it helps them get a better return on their investment.
Now, you've been doing this, working with our churches and schools for some time, what, 3-4 years now. Do you know how many you've worked with over those years?
I've probably consulted or at least had conversations with over 200 individual churches and schools. I would say of those, about 120 of them actually moved forward with the recommendations that I was able to provide them. The other 80%, or the other those sites that did not, wasn't for a lack of interest. It's just that based on what we were able to find, they either had a very good package already in place, or we couldn't at least find another carrier that could provide the services they wanted in the geographical area they were located in.
I would assume those would be some of our remote, you know, more remoter congregations and schools.
Right.
When you have fewer options.
That is exactly correct. In many cases, you just have a single carrier that provides those services in that area, and that kind of limits your options. Again, that's what AT&T and Verizon were lobbying for a couple of years ago when they had the FCC rules changed, is in many areas, other wholesale companies could buy and sell AT&T services at reduced rates in these geographical areas. Now AT&T and Verizon basically got that wiped out, so they were able to eliminate competition for themselves and limit the options that and churches and schools have in certain areas.
So, Mark, I have a question. Is the services that you offer, are they nationwide? I mean, any congregation or school throughout the whole well system can contact you for this help?
That is correct. Most of the carriers that we have been working with, or I have been working with, and we've made available through this program are national carriers. There are certain regional carriers that have a little bit limited reach. One Communications would fall into that category. They're very much east of the Mississippi geographical area, but considering the Wells footprint, that still actually kind of lines up with where our churches and schools are. But yes, they are nation. In fact, they are global if we really wanted to. But that's getting into another area.
So what kind of savings are you seeing when you're working with congregations, at least where they have some choices? And I assume that's kind of the driver behind a lot of what you do, is trying to get costs down for churches and schools when they're looking at a phone provider and an internet provider?
That is correct. Actually, when I first started this work about 3-4 years ago, we were seeing on average of about 50% reduction. However, over the last year or two, we've seen those initial savings drop. Now they're down more to 20%. And again, it's based on what carrier they have in place today, whether or not they're under contracts today that may reduce those rates even further. But I think some of that also is in response to, you know, the competition kind of getting wiser and modifying their pricing. I mean, AT&T used to be the most expensive company out there, and now they've obviously come back with a much more competitive rate, and that's part of what's driving the lessening of the savings that we're finding initially. But the second piece to that, and I think this is an important piece, is what I'm finding is while the rates may be similar between carriers, when we actually take a look at their phone bill and look at what they're needing to have versus what's in place, we're finding a very big mismatch, meaning in some cases, you know, companies are paying for unlimited calls, local calls, when in fact they are only making, you know, 100 calls a month. And what happens is they start overpaying with the provider they're on. So the savings we're able to find, not only is it between different carriers, but also a kind of a truing up of how they're using their services and what they really need, and matching those up to what they're going to pay for going forward.
Makes sense, absolutely. So win-win for the church or the school, regardless of whether it's their own carrier lowering their rates, or you working with them to kind of tweak the setup so that they're not paying for things that they're really not using.
Right. One of the things I can bring just with my experience is, you know, there are definitely some algorithms, or a simpler term is just different equations you can use that really help individual locations figure out what they need. I mean, there is a local call ratio, long distance ratios, and depending on their call usage, definitely has an effect on how many phone lines they really actually need to have. In many cases, we were finding that there were extra lines in there that didn't need to be in there, just because when you look at their usage, they just didn't need them. Mm-hmm. And again, that allows us to reduce costs by actually eliminating services that they were paying for at that point in time.
Sure. when you're working with these churches and schools, what are some of the common questions they have about their, I assume there's some commonalities with some of the questions when they're looking at that complicated bill and scratching their heads. You know, what are their questions when they approach you and say, hey, I don't understand this, or I'm not sure if I'm getting the best deal?
Well, that's actually one of the very first questions. Obviously, being non-for-profit organizations, everybody wants to kind of maximize what they get for what they're paying. So obviously, are there better options or better priced options out there is probably the leading question with all of these locations. I've been mm-hmm. receiving more and more questions regarding voice over IP technology. I think a lot of locations are kind of questioning what are the advantages, what are the disadvantages of voice over IP, when is it good, when is it bad for me. That not only covers the hardware side of things and as new phone systems are being looked at, but also from a carrier perspective, because obviously people hear on the TV, voice over IP has, free calls. Well, what does that really mean? How does it work? What kind of quality guarantees are you going to get with voice over IP technology? So a lot of questions in that arena. And we also are actually getting a number of questions regarding tax-exempt status, what kind of rules are in effect in the industry, what do they, should they be charged for, what shouldn't they be charged for. I find, incredibly, a lot of churches and schools are being taxed, even though they're tax-exempt. That's a very easy area. You just need to submit a tax-exempt certificate into the carrier to get those removed. But, that I see a lot of those kind of charges still on a bill. So those are the areas.
Let's talk a little bit about Internet access. I know that more and more, definitely all of our schools are interested in it for educational purposes, but now even our churches are trying to staff their offices with good Internet access, good broadband Internet access. First of all, I've heard that schools can qualify for free Internet service, at least in some locations. Is that accurate?
It is. For the simple answer is, it is, depending on what you said, where they're physically located.
Mm-hmm.
Not all locations have that. Obviously, it's cable companies that are the biggest provider of free Internet service. Very local Internet service provider companies also provide that kind of as a caveat to churches and schools in the area. But there are the rules on free service is changing, and there are definitely some caps on what's free and what's not. So cable companies are providing free service, but one of the caveats is cable companies, they need to have a run or going past their location. And if the lateral, the distance from where an existing cable run is to the building is too far, they'll charge you for the construction fees to extend that lateral connection into the building. Well, that's a fee that some sites aren't aware of when it comes to free service. Phone companies have actually moved away from free Internet service. They actually are now treating most of the non-for-profit locations as small businesses. And as such, they have to pay for any services that they bring into their location, whether it's voice services or the Internet services.
Is there typically any breaks for charities or nonprofits over and against small businesses, or they just kind of get lumped together?
They get all lumped together. Again, it's the cable companies that are doing the most free service. They're just extending off of community cable runs that are going to service a community. Again, you've got the construction fees for bringing those laterals into the service, but I've just recently found out that in the Wisconsin area, specifically Charter Communications, they're actually now requiring any schools that have churches connected to them, they physically have to make sure they're disassociated. That, in many cases, schools were getting the free Internet service, and then through wireless hubs or just connecting them on their local area network, they were providing that Internet services to the church. The cable companies are coming back now requiring that in order to get the free service, you have to separate the church out, and the church is not allowed to piggyback on that free Internet connection. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the rule changes that are coming, that are starting to take place as these cable companies are starting to change their policies around free internet.
Right.
So free internet is really just a generous offering by the company, and it varies company to company. It's not something that's mandated or anything like that. No federal programs for free internet or anything like that.
That is correct. The way that if you want to look at those program offers, what they really are, there are programs that exist out there, such as the E-rate program and the school aid program, that will reimburse the telecommunication companies for those services. But as far as the companies providing the service, those for the most part are primarily moving more and more towards billable service offerings. And then a school would actually go ahead and need to fill out paperwork through the E-rate or school aid program that will, in essence, have the federal government pay their phone bills or their internet bills to those carriers from a federal fund.
So those programs would be available if you're not getting the free service, and this would also qualify for phone service as well. But I understand some of those programs are somewhat laden with paperwork and very difficult process to go through. Has that been your experience with? I assume you help schools with some of those as well, the E-rates and the school rates.
I have. Right. They are kind of cumbersome. There are specific ways you need to fill it out. If you don't fill it out correctly, that will hang the process, the paperwork up in the process once you submit them. There's multiple follow-up calls you need to make, and those processes are always evolving. So you're kind of trying to submit paperwork on a moving target, and it makes it tougher. So even if you've gone through it 1 year, the process may change a bit the second year. So it's always a learning experience. I do want to take a step back on the free internet. There's one exception I guess I wanted to point out for churches and schools, in that a lot of wireless companies are, kind of sprouting up to service some of the more rural areas and rural communities. And I've actually seen a number of different instances where either the schools can just pick up free internet from a wireless perspective because they happen to be in the range of that offering. Or I'm seeing that these providers, these wireless internet providers, are actually making deals with churches and schools to co-locate their equipment that's going to service a geographical region inside the church or school. And in exchange for the free co-location aspect of it, they then get free internet service. I know, in fact, David Starr up in Jackson, Wisconsin, just did that, had that done. They actually arranged for a deal where a wireless provider placed a wireless broadcaster in the steeple of their church. And in exchange, they ran some additional equipment that was located in a closet inside the church proper, but in exchange for providing that space, they're now getting like 5 megs of free internet speeds from the provider.
Oh, worth looking into, especially for our rural congregations, potentially, because a lot of those wireless providers are looking at expanding in those areas.
Right. A lot of them were working on, like, farm silos and placing their equipment on silos, but they're actually moving away from silos because there's too much interference, and they can't get necessarily the line of sight that they're looking for. But what it's hard to work on, from my perspective, it's hard for me to educate people on that because it's so
right.
localized that it's really just, it's more the local community being aware of maybe a provider interested in their area and then maybe making a proactive phone call in.
Great. So if somebody wants to take advantage of the ShopWells program or to reach out to you to get help from you, especially as it relates to their phone setup and internet, how can they do that, Mark?
Well, they can contact me directly by phone if they'd like. 262-546-0088 is my office number. If I'm unavailable, they can just leave me a voicemail and I'll return their call. I'm usually pretty good about getting back to them within 24 hours. They also can email us at mark.robinson@dviconsulting.net, And I believe we also have a secondary one, I think, email that's admin@wells.net, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So either way is fine.
Okay. And if you want to know more about the ShopWells program or learn more about any of the other ones, and we'll probably have Mark on, you know, in a few months to talk about the other offerings within ShopWells, that website is www.shopwells.net. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
It was great to talk with Mark. He definitely has a lot of experience within the very complicated area of telecommunications. I know when I look at my phone bill, I just really have no idea what services are being provided, what I'm being charged for, what I should and shouldn't be provided or charged for. And I think our members, our churches and our schools would do well to connect with Mark if they haven't already done so to get some advice on, you know, are they in the best situation?
Sure, I totally agree. Just that simple tip of, you know, nonprofits shouldn't be charged taxes. You know, I wonder how many congregations out there are being charged tax on their telephone bills.
Right.
It's really great to have somebody on your side.
Yep. So take advantage of Mark and what he does for the Synod. He's a real blessing to us. Now it's time for our picks of the week. Sally, what's up this week for you?
Well, today I want to talk about one of my very favorite top-of-the-list software applications. It's called Snagit, and it's produced by a company from Michigan called TechSmith. The application actually is designed for taking screen captures or pictures of your computer screen and the things that are on your screen so that you can make digital images of those screen images and use them. You know, a lot of people might use it to develop documentation or training materials. That's probably their first area of customers, you know, that would be interested in their product. However, what I've found is that it's just an incredibly easy and intuitive product for doing any type of image editing. Certainly in my position, I do a lot of screen captures, but I also use my Snagit software for adding annotations, making cropping and different adjustments to digital images, and I can even use it to record screencast video. So if I'm explaining something about a website, I can make a little short video about it to share with someone. So just an excellent product, and adding to how wonderful it is the price tag, because it's just incredibly affordable for what you get with this product. The normal price for it is $40, but they actually have nonprofit pricing that's only $33 for a copy of the software. And then if you're buying multiple copies, they go down to up to a 50% discount off their normal pricing, depending on how many copies you're purchasing. So if you want to get hooked on some great software, you can go over to techsmith.com and download their free 30-day trial of Snagit. And I can almost guarantee that if you try it for 30 days, if you do any kind of image editing, you're going to be hooked on this great software.
Yeah, I can think of some applications for churches, especially the church management software that a lot of us are using these days can get kind of complicated, and everybody maybe has some different processes for how to track membership and do attendance and those kinds of things. And just doing a little bit of a screencast, it's really easy to do, you know, would be a great way to document that for other volunteers, where they can just watch a little video, a little screencast about how to enter attendance or some things to do when they're adding a new member or changing membership information, those kinds of things. So lots of application. I've used it, and a great tool. And the price is excellent as well, as you mentioned. My pick of the week is really not a standalone piece of software. It's just some functionality within the Microsoft Office suite, and especially within Microsoft Word, and that's the wizards that come with it related to mail merge. Maybe a mysterious feature for a lot of church and school secretaries or pastors, but mail merge is an excellent, excellent way to customize both letters, and that's what most people use it for, but also now emails. You have the ability with the mail merge function whether it's Office 2003 or Office 2007, to create a list of users, their email addresses, their addresses, and then merge that with a letter or an email that you've crafted that would incorporate their name in the salutation, that would incorporate their information, whether it be, you know, their address or their, you know, more personal names within the body of the message itself. And when you send it, it comes across certainly much less a form letter, even though maybe you're sending it out to 20, 30, or 300 people, because you've personalized that. Just a great thing to think about using, and so easy to use because Microsoft has made it fairly easy with a couple button pushes to walk you through the process. We're not going to go through that here, but just something that, you know, I would encourage congregations and schools to look at using, because it's so easy to do. So Mail Merge, take a look at it, a great tool that congregations can use to kind of personalize their communications.
And I know Microsoft has a lot of free online training resources, so I believe we'll be able to post a link to some online training about the mail merge process in our show notes.
Yeah, let us know how you're using it. If you are using it now, there are many uses for it. So Mail Merge in the Microsoft suite. There's also Mail Merge in some of the other applications as well. Up next, our Wells.net feature. Sally, what's up this week?
Well, I was excited to share with you this week a Bible study that's available online. So if you're looking for a way to merge your Bible study with your technology interest, you might want to check out the What About Jesus John Bible Study. It's part of our Wells.net University website, and you can find it at wells.net/jump/John Bible Study. Or you can find a link on the What About Jesus Study the Bible page. So a couple of ways to get access to it. What you're going to get when you get there is basically 24 lessons, very easy to complete, one per day if you want, covering the entire book of John, the Gospel of John. And with each lesson, you'll have things to study, things to read from the Bible, and then there's quizzes associated, and there's commentary and things that you can kind of meditate on and just focus on the Gospel of John and get through a really nice Bible study over just 24 short lessons. I mentioned it's sponsored by the What About Jesus site. That's our evangelism website, and just an excellent resource out there. There's been quite a few people that have taken advantage of it already out on the Wells.net University site, and I encourage you to check it out.
So that's What About Jesus John Bible Study on Wells.net University. Thanks, Sally. What's going on within the Wells this week?
Well, there's actually lots of things going on in the Wells, and what I wanted to direct you to was the Wells calendar of events that's part of the Wells.net website. You can get to it several different ways, but a link to all of the 2008 events is at wells.net/jump/WC2008 for Wells Calendar 2008. And what you're going to find there is a complete calendar listing of all the conferences, retreats, concerts, camping events, just anything that's going on in the Wells is posted out on this comprehensive Wells Calendar of events. And there's even a link there where you can submit your own events to the Wells office so they can be added to the calendar. So if you're looking to know what's going on, this is a great place to check out.
Yeah, just kind of the one-stop shop for everything going on of general interest, to Wells members and Wells congregation. So check that resource out. Up next is our community feedback section. It was busy this week. We were hearing from a lot of people.
Well, we checked out our Delicious tag, Wells Tech, out on the Delicious website. That's del.icio.us. And that's a way for listeners to share different websites or links with us that they found useful for ministry purposes. And this week we heard from user R.A. Faust, who recommended Doodle. You can find it at www.doodle.ch. And he said it was a cool tool to narrow down a time to meet with a group of busy people, which is one of the functions they kind of promote on the Doodle website. Basically, what it is a free online polling service. You don't have to have any account or anything. You just set up a poll, it generates a link, and you can send that link out to people. So if you want to, for instance, decide on a meeting time between a group of people. You can set up a simple little poll that says, would you rather meet on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday? And they can go to the website, cast their vote, and as the administrator of that poll, you can see the results of the poll. So very quick and easy to set up, no cost at all, and just a real convenient website. So we thank R.A. Faust for sharing that link with us.
I know that whether we like it or not, churches and schools are full of meetings, so this is a great resource to try and pick a time that makes sense for everybody involved, especially if you're dealing with more than just a couple people. Meeting management is just a struggle for a lot of congregations to try and find a night and a time with everybody's busy schedule. So that would be Doodle. We'll put the link in the show notes there. We also had a follow-up message from James Wilcox from Rapid City, South Dakota. A number of shows ago, we talked with Rob Benson, our security administrator here in the Synod Administration Building. We're talking about a little bit about VPNs, or virtual private networks, and how individuals that are working within the context of the church or for the church's volunteers or church workers, how they get to the resources that are on the network at the church. And a VPN is one way to do that. We talked about different ways to do that, but James shared with us a tool that he found from a company called Hamachi, which is free, and we'll provide the link in the show notes, which allows you to fairly easily set up a virtual private network that would allow somebody from the outside to get at assets within the congregation. So great information there. It sounds like something that's working well for him, and maybe something that if you're interested or your congregation or school is interested in putting together, might be something to consider as we try to get more and more connected. And we talked about that virtual church office as well. This is one way to get at that. Again, that's Hamachi, and we'll post the link to that information in the show notes.
Excellent resource. Finally, I wanted to add one more comment from listener Carl Henslin, who wrote to us as a follow-up of our conversation on the Logos Bible study software that we talked with Pastor Fry about last week in our show. He also sent a couple of links to additional resources that you could use for Bible study. One is fee-based, but he says very nominal fee. To get the NIV version of the Bible, you can go to eSword and get access to the NIV version and many foreign language versions of the Bible. And then one that is free is BibleGateway.com, which is one of my favorite websites where you can go and search the Bible online. And the NIV is free there at BibleGateway.com. So a couple of great resources for cost-effective Bible study solutions.
So thank you so much to our listeners for contributing to the show. Again, anybody can do that via email, voicemail, adding comments to our posts on wellstech.wells.net. There's lots of ways for you to get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you, and that really helps us to figure out, you know, what we should maybe be considering for future shows. So keep those comments and those feedbacks coming. Well, Sally, we reached the end of another show. As usual, we will close the show by featuring another Wells artist. This one we have not heard from before, Don Galhar. She is a pianist, and we're going to be playing her song, Christ Be My Leader, on her album, Inspirations. Dawn is reworking her website at this point, so if you'd like to get in touch with Dawn, please send us an email, and we will hook you up if you'd like to purchase some of her music. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We will see you next week.